Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, writer Mickey Duxbury, is on a mission to challenge stereotypes about people who've spent time in prison for major crimes. She interviewed 20 formerly incarcerated people, most from Alameda County, about their upbringings, being in and out of prison, and the challenges involved when they got out for the last time and re-entered society. She writes, quote, "The people who so generously share their stories here came from a wide range of circumstances. Some came from two-parent middle-class families, and some came from families impacted by crime and addiction for generations. Some came from families traumatized by domestic violence, and some were sexually molested as children. Many were introduced to crime at a young age. Many had no access to drug treatment while in prison. Upon release, they often returned to communities already impacted by poverty and crime." End quote. Photos and stories of the former prisoners are on display at Oakland City Hall as part of the Welcome Home Project. Mickey Duxbury hopes that the exhibit will challenge the notion that people involved in crime cannot or will not change. The Welcome Home Project is on display on the third floor of Oakland City Hall through October 29th, and there will be a panel tomorrow at the First Unitarian Church of Oakland at 7 p.m., the corner of 14th and Castro. Today we are joined by Mickey Duxbury. She's a writer and activist focusing on the effects of mass incarceration, and she's project coordinator for the Welcome Home Project, and she joins me here in studio. Hi, Mickey. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning. I'm very glad to be here.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Alice Washington, age 60. Alice has a drug and alcohol counseling certificate and a BA in psychology. She's working on her master's as a family therapist, involved in crime between the ages of 26 and 36, Alice was in and out of county jail and served 5 years in Valley State Prison. And Alice also joins me in studio. Hi, Alice. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you. Hi.
Great to have you. And we're joined by Nicole Petway, age 47. Nicole spent 5 years in county jails and 8 years in California state prisons. Nicole is a certified addictions treatment counselor at a reentry program in San Francisco and is completing her bachelor's degree. She hopes to open a transitional house for women leaving the criminal justice system. And Nicole is also in studio. Hi, Nicole. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you.
So I hope I'm not putting you on the spot, but right before we went live and I had to cut you off, you were thanking Mickey for doing this project. You said you have not yet had a chance to thank her.
Yeah, I haven't had the chance. We've been emailing, phone calls. She's been very proactive in making sure that everyone knows where to be, who can speak, who can reach out, who can, you know, meet the public and get the stories out. And I haven't had an opportunity to thank her for all of her energy in the interviews. We got real personal with a lot of intimate, traumatizing backgrounds. And one of the things that I've learned about in my trainings as an addiction treatment counselor is about countertransference and transference. And she seems to maintain this empathetic way of listening, but also protecting herself so that she doesn't absorb some of the pains mm-hmm. that we have. And I just want to thank you very much, Mickey, personally. And I'm honored. I'm honored that you chose me as well as the other participants to participate.
Well, I want to say because, you know,
Mickey.
I'm honored and that it has been a real blessing to work with everybody in the Welcome Home Project. And, you know, this is some point I might have gotten to later in the hour, but here we are jumping off into it right away. I'd say 95% of the people, of the 20 people that were interviewed for the project, have had serious trauma in their childhood. And no one and none of the participants would say, oh, that's why I did crime and that's somehow like it's excused or anything. But the reality is for most people that go on, trauma in early childhood and middle childhood and exposure to crime and criminality is a main reason why people get involved in crime and drug addiction. And so these stories are not just people that are formerly incarcerated that have been successful, they got a job, they had good drug treatment. These stories are healing stories because every single person in the book, in order to really turn their lives around, they had to address stuff that was on the inside also. They had to look at trauma that they'd had or domestic abuse that they'd had or how badly they felt about themselves and how drugs were self-medicating them because... Mm-hmm. And those are the people that came to me, that I found. So I just want to, the primary point I'm trying to get across is that I think as a public, we have this awareness like people are criminals, and we say these words that are very demonizing. It's sort of like mm-hmm. illegal aliens, and then that becomes that person instead of committing crime is some of what this person did, but this person is many other things. They are mothers, lovers, partners, fathers, brothers, and they have tools and skills that, if given the opportunities, they could be using. So it's been witnessing people who have turned their lives around. And I'll just say one last thing about that. Somebody the other day said to me, because I use that expression, turn their lives around, and I use it a lot because people in the Welcome Home Project use it a lot. It's an expression that comes some out of the recovery movement about really turning things around. And it implies a kind of healing. And someone said to me, well, I don't like that expression because it puts too much onus on the individual when there's really systems of poverty and racism mm-hmm. and economic and not jobs and not welcoming home that have to do why people stay involved in crime. And so I want to make it clear those are both things. Of course, there are structural systemic issues around poverty and institutionalized racism and mass incarceration that influence crime and criminality. And in order for someone to really turn away from that life, they have to come to something inside themselves that they have to make decisions to change. It's not just the world outside that needs to change.
That is Mickey Duxbury. She's a writer and activist focusing on the effects of mass incarceration. She's project coordinator for the Welcome Home Project. She interviewed 20 formerly incarcerated people, most from Alameda County, about their childhoods, being in and out of prison, the challenges involved when they got out for the last time and re-entered society. And this photo exhibit is on display on the third floor of Oakland City Hall through October 29th. And thank you, Mickey, for bringing in this amazing photo book. It's almost like a calendar, and it shows a photo of 20 of the people you interviewed along with their stories. And Alice, you've got this great picture by the water. Your arms are spread out. You just look so happy. And you do share so many intimate details of your life. And you write, my husband was abusive and beat me when I didn't want to do drugs. I was 35 and pregnant and decided I didn't want a crack baby. My daughter was born clean, but then I got back on crack. I mean, you're sharing very intimate details.
Yes.
Why did you decide to share these details, and what has that experience been like for you?
I just felt like being open and honest about me was something that I needed to do. Mickey was very easy to talk to, and it was like if she was going to get the story, get the real story. I didn't want to sugarcoat it because it's what happened. You know, it's the part of my life. That's what happened. That's what I did. As soon as I had my daughter, I couldn't wait to give birth to a clean baby, one, but I couldn't wait to start back using. I wasn't ready to stop.
Can you explain that? Why? Because there's so many stereotypes, like Mickey said, in our society about people who use drugs. And so can you talk about why? I mean, you had a clean baby, but then you couldn't wait to use crack again.
Well, for one, my husband wasn't too happy when I had the baby because I had stopped using with him. And so he said, as soon as you have that baby, you're going to be getting high again with me. And by any means necessary, I had to go out and steal and just sell the products that I stole to make sure that we could get high. So it was like, oh my God, I can't wait to get this over with because I knew if I didn't, I would probably be abused again. So,
but you eventually left.
I left.
How did you find the will and the strength to leave?
Because in my heart, I knew I wasn't raised like that. Mm. And being a 35-year-old woman with your first kid, I wanted to be a mom. I wanted a kid more than anything in the world. And she didn't ask to come here. And I just want to be a mom to love my child and not abuse her like I was being abused.
You were involved in crime between the ages of 26 and 36. You were in and out of county jail, and you served 5 years in Valley State Prison.
Yes.
And that was at Chowchilla. And yes. Your mom sounds like an amazing woman because she moved to Chowchilla to make it possible for your daughter to grow up close to you. And they came to see you Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday
every
for five years. That's an amazing mother you have.
Yes. And my mother had gotten sick in between coming to see me, and she would, you know, roll her oxygen tank out. Wow. And she says, you know, I can't keep doing this. I get so tired and breaking my oxygen tank down just to make sure I don't have drugs in it. And she eventually had to stop coming because she was bedridden with congestive heart failure. And so she made sure that my brothers would make sure my daughter was there every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday to visit.
And that is Alice Washington. She has a drug and alcohol counseling certificate and a BA in psychology. And you're currently working on your master's as a family therapist?
Yes.
Congratulations.
Yes. Thank you.
Alice is featured in the Welcome Home Project exhibit at Oakland City Hall. It's on display through October 29th.
If you'd like to support the Welcome Home Project, you may go online to communityworkswest.org.
What stereotypes and prejudices do you have about people who've spent time in prison? I mean, we'd love to have an honest conversation here because Mickey Duxbury really wants to challenge these stereotypes. We all have them about people who have committed major crimes and are in prison for this, people who go in and out of prison, people who do drugs. And there's a lot of people believe that people in prison cannot change or won't change. And this is really the stereotype that Mickey Duxbury is taking on by sharing the stories of 20 formerly incarcerated people. We'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866.
This is a rebroadcast of your call. We cannot accept calls at this time. Thank you.
Family member who's been incarcerated. What was the experience been like? How hard was it for you or your family, a family member or friend, to readjust back to everyday life? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. You can also leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So, Nikki, you're also featured in the beautiful book that Mickey put together. You write, I was born and raised in Boston. Because of my very light skin, I had a lot of identity crises because I was identified with my African-American culture. But it was difficult because neighborhoods and schools were segregated. As a child, I had traumatic experiences. My stepfather molested me when I was very young, and it went on for years, but I never told anybody. And I learned to cope with it through manipulation. What was it like for you to share this story or to share this story so publicly now?
I guess I held on to the pain for so long that it was time to give my pain a voice. You know, we go through trauma after trauma after trauma, and it's almost like our spirit begins to callous in a way where we don't allow others to get in. We don't allow others to get close to us. And so learning to manipulate and wean our way through daily life's situations become normal for us. Well, I will speak for myself, became normal for me. And so, given the opportunity to tell someone, you know, one of the sayings in recovery is that we're only as sick as our secrets. And I can just remember that for a good while, I was able to manipulate my stepfather for the things that I wanted in threatening him to tell, that I would tell. But one of my biggest fears is if I did tell, that my oldest brother would do something to him. And I learned how to bond with my perpetrator. Although he was molesting me and in the night times became the scary times, in the daytime it was still the father figure that I had in my life. It was still the person who tied my shoe. It was still the person that, you know, held my hand as we walked down the street in a form of protection. So it was, you know, kind of a conundrum for me as a young child of trying to understand and comprehend the person, you know, that you look to guide you, and is also taking advantage of that innocence and taking advantage of that, you know, that part of your spirit, you know. And because I was the youngest of six children and there were so many different age groups for my mother to maintain and take care of, you know, I know that she did the best that she could with the information that she had. I know that today. But I often felt invisible, often wondered, don't you see how difficult it is for me to separate from you? You know, like when my mom would leave and go somewhere, the tantrum that I would, you know, display of, Mommy, please don't leave me, why that wasn't a signal or, you know, a red flag, so to speak. Of course, in today's times and societies, mothers who are in tune with their children and who are emotionally available for their children, they would look at that as a red flag. But at that time in the 60s and 70s, you know, it was like, oh, she'll be fine, Mommy. Just go on, you know.
You say in this, in the book, because you didn't get much attention, you looked for love in all the wrong places. And by 14, you write, I was sleeping with men, or you tell Mickey, I was sleeping with men for money. I felt a sense of power and control, even though I was out of control on the inside. I started freebasing cocaine when I was 16, and it helped me put on a facade.
Yeah, you know, I could work at McDonald's and make minimum wage for those times, or I could sleep with the manager of the McDonald's and make more money. But it wasn't really about the money. It was about, for me, like taking my power back. Like I had something that you want, and you were willing to give me something for it, and I could dictate what it is that I was going to get, you know. And, you know, these are the, you know, they say that we... You know, we learn addictive traits even before the drugs become part of the symptom. And so I can remember, you know, the men playing dominoes in front of the store, you know, where I could say, you know, I know that they want to touch me. And so give me 25 cents so I can buy 25 pieces of penny candy for my friends. You know, and when you learn how to maneuver again through, you know, the daily, you know, traumas that you experience, you move that on forward. And, you know, again, it was a sense of control. It was a sense of power, I should say.
Mm-hmm. Mickey.
I'd like to just add something about, you know, the sense of control and power. And I think for almost everyone in the book, lit calendar, and it's made to be in a calendar format so people will hang it up, and we hope for this to be inside prisons and jails, and and it's you know what you do when you have something that looks and feels like a calendar with a hole in it, you put it on the wall. We want these pictures to be inspiring to people, and I think they will be. But you know, many of the people, and I think you could extrapolate this to many of the people that are incarcerated, that somewhere in early childhood, mid-childhood, there was some kind of issue, whether it was bullying at school or low self-esteem or a combination of divorce and moving or addicted mom. There was some combination of issues so that when drugs became available to them, it wasn't just because, oh, that's cool, that's a drug. They were boosting their self-esteem with the drugs. So when somebody was dealing by the time they were 10 years old, at sixth grade, this one person in the book said, you know, it's silly, but I was fat and I had learning disabilities. And, you know, when I was the one that could divvy out marijuana, like all of a sudden I was, you know, a king. So people got power and respect in drug dealing. There's a lot of power in being a major drug dealer. And some of the people in the book speak about when they got higher and higher up in drug dealing and gun violence involved in that, they felt even more authority. So really what we're saying is that these are very disempowered, marginalized folks a fair amount of time that have no sense of internal power. And then criminality becomes a way to, you know, gain power. So we have to, as a society, people with all of us, we need to create systems that are more empowering to people. And so just to be concrete, when people get out, not only do they need jobs and resources and treatment programs, they need a pull of opportunities and welcoming that's as stronger than the pull of the streets. Mm-hmm. Because the streets are always there and they're easy. If that's the tools you have and that's how you know to pick up $10,000, $5,000 or whatever it is within the next couple of weeks, why would you do something else? We have to circumvent that. And there's attempts, and there are some very good reentry programs in California, but it is not up to scale with the need by any shit.
That is Mickey Duxbury. She's project coordinator for the Welcome Home Project, which features 20 formerly incarcerated people and stories about their upbringings, being in and out of prison, and the challenges involved when they got out for the very last time and reentered society. The Welcome Home Project exhibit is on display on the third
floor. If you'd like to support the Welcome Home Project, you may go online to communityworkswest.org.
Corner of 14th and Castro, starting at 7 p.m., and formerly incarcerated Alameda County residents will share their stories. We're also joined by Alice Washington and Nicole Petway. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798.
You are listening to a rebroadcast episode of Your Call. We cannot accept calls at this time, but thank you.
Robert in Richmond. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you very much. First of all, I just wanted to congratulate everybody on your show. I do a lot of work. I'm an attorney, and I do a lot of work with rehabilitation and people who want to get state-issued licenses. This is not a pitch for business, but I do very much respect the people that you're talking to and the kind of challenges that they have to, you know, use their experience to help other people. And the state puts in certain, challenges. Some are justified, some are just difficult. First of all, I wanted to ask, how is it that they are able, or how difficult is it for them to find placements as counselors and to be able to use, you know, their difficult life experiences to turn that into gold for other people? And the second thing is, off the air, if they want to find a way to contact me, or if I'll get their phone number, I would be willing to do a certain amount of limited pro bono work. I'm a small office, but that could be of some help, I think, in helping people understand what they have to show the state in order for them to say, okay, yeah, we'll give you a license. Anyway, that's it. I just wanted to congratulate people because this is exactly the kind of work I see people needing.
Well, thank you, Robert. If you can email your contact info to feedback@yourcallradio.org, that would be great. And thanks so much for calling. Do you want to jump in, Nicole, just quickly before we go to break?
Yes. In terms of the question that the gentleman was asking, I think one of the things, I mean, for me, in the county of San Francisco, I really believe that the reentry and the realignment legislature and working from the criminal justice aspect to the restorative justice aspect, where we have ex-felons working on the reentry council.
I'm sorry to cut you off. We're going to take just a quick break. Today we're talking about the Welcome Home Project and what it takes to reenter society. We'll be back after this. We'll be right back.
On tomorrow's edition of Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Tavis Smiley. He wrote the book Death of a King, the real story of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s final year. In his last year, King was campaigning against many things, many of the same issues we still face today: poverty, racism, and war overseas. So what is the true legacy of the famous civil rights leader, and how has it been making impact today? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you, tomorrow on this station.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about the Welcome Home Project. It's an exhibit on display on the third floor of Oakland City Hall through October 29th. Today's guest, writer Mickey Duxbury, interviewed 20 formerly incarcerated people about their upbringings, being in and out of prison, and the challenges involved when they got out for the last time and re-entered society. And Mickey is project coordinator for the Welcome Home Project. Tomorrow there will be a panel at the First Unitarian Church.
If you'd like to support the Welcome Home Project, you may go online to communityworkswest.org.
About their stories. Alice Washington is a guest today. She's featured in the exhibit. Alice has a drug and alcohol counseling certificate and a BA in psychology. She's working on her master's as a family therapist. Alice was involved in crime between the ages of 26 and 36. She was in and out of county jail and served 5 years in Valley State Prison. Nicole Petway spent 5 years in county jails and 8 years in California state prisons. Nicole is a certified addictions treatment counselor at a reentry program in San Francisco and is completing her bachelor's. She hopes to open a transitional house for women leaving the criminal justice system. And sorry for cutting you off there, Nicole, but can you address the question about the difficulties in finding placements as a counselor in these fields?
What I was trying to explain is that a lot of agencies have really gone from the criminal justice aspect of dealing with clients. I was going to say offenders, but we're trying to move away from the word offenders to clients, to residents. And what better person to deal with the population than someone who's been there, someone who can empathize and sympathize and actually help the person, bring them along, not necessarily just because they, you know, of their past stories, but if you put a person's life experiences with some education, some training, and some information on how to present what it takes to the next individual, how to succeed. Because, you know, we talk about one addict helping another one is without parallel, right? We talk about an each one, teach one type of mentality. Okay. So if you have someone who is a drug and alcohol counselor who is also working a program of recovery for themselves, you know, because we can't stay clean through our work. You need to know that. It is a continuous, ongoing process of basically debriefing after work, and we have lives. And, you know, but in terms of being able to obtain employment and being able to go through the Clean Slate program, being able to get your felony convictions brought down to misdemeanors and even dismissed, you know, those things are available. I can tell you that for me, in my addiction, the getting and using and finding ways and means to get more is what I did on a daily basis from the time I woke up, if I went to sleep that night, right, until the wee hours of the next morning. So today, not only in my recovery, but in my quest to and my passion to reach others that change is possible, I go after it the same way. And any person, you know, like me or similar to me, or, you know, can change.
We did a show a few days ago about Proposition 47, which would reclassify nonviolent crimes to a misdemeanor. And we learned that there aren't that many drug rehabilitation programs in California counties. And I'm just wondering what your experiences were like. Because, Nicole, you told Mickey that when you finally realized you had a disease that affected your behavior, things started to change. And handcuffs were always a divine intervention for you. So what was you, did you find help in prison? Were you able to deal with these issues?
I did. And I can tell you that I was freer in the institution than I was on the streets. You know, it was in the institution where I was finally able to get that moment of clarity to say, to come from that pre-contemplative stage of change to the contemplative stage of change, and then, you know, really trying to prepare and move into action. And if it wasn't for the in-custody treatment programs that were either in county jails or in state prisons and or in the community, you know, I came out. So a lot of people say I need to relearn. I needed to learn from Jump Street, right? The things that I needed to acquire in order to become a functional, responsible, productive member of society. And there was a program for me at the time that was a homeless shelter for people on parole. And had it not been for my parole officer and the counselors in the institution that I was able to say, look, I've been on this revolving door for this many years. I cannot hit the street without continuing to go on the downward spiral. I need to go from prison to treatment so that I can learn gradually, you know, on a pendulum type change to reintegrate back into my community. And those are one of the most important things that a person needs getting out of the institution. So that's what worked for me.
I just want to add, well, a few things. Nicole's experience is very powerful example of when there's good programs in line and when people, and San Francisco is a real head of the curve here. It's not true most of the rest of California. So we have to be very aware that inside the barrier, San Quentin, for example, has the richness of many different people and volunteers that go in. There's 18-month programs for people to really unmask some of trauma, the hyper-masculine identity, and how that has to do with roles of crime. Those kinds of programs are not throughout the California prison system. And by and large, most people in this project, and generally speaking, I think it's fair to say, there is not adequate drug treatment programs inside prison, nowhere near adequate. And just having a program that talks about not using drugs is not the kind of recovery and healing that you get to have. So there's a lot to be done, and there's a strong move that it should be, as Nicole says, a continuum on the outside, so that reentry should start from the minute somebody goes into prison, should be identifying what were your risks and how did you become involved in crime and what are those criminogenic factors and how could we address those as you're getting out. Most people still, they're getting out of California prisons, they've got $200 at the gate, and they get that bus ticket. And then they land in Oakland, California, where it costs, you know, $1,100 for a single-room occupancy if they're lucky. So the obstacles are very, very strong. So I want to make that very clear to the listening audience. And I want to speak just a little about this licensing issue. One of the people in the book, John Holman, he won't mind that I mention his name, he works at Healthy Oakland or Healthy Communities, and it's a program in Oakland that serves formerly incarcerated folks and many marginal people and people on the street in terms of medical and mental health and referral and case management, et cetera. And he's been there for 9 years. He's now the site coordinator and technology director there. And he applied to enroll people in the California Obamacare program so he can enroll patients at that medical facility, and he was denied because of his felony. So he had to go through a process because he's someone that is in the reentry field. He's at the table in Alameda County supporting change. There were many people, including myself, that supported him with letters, and he got through that. Most people do not that kind of support. They don't even get that far. They don't even think that they're going to be applied. The obstacles, you can't get food stamps. You cannot be in public housing. The laws are still in place. If you've had felonies, you cannot go to public housing. And if you visit your wife who's in public housing and the police find out about it, your wife can be kicked out of public housing. So we need to really examine women, that these ideas that people can should be changing totally, we have a job to create the conditions that allows that possibility of change. And I'm sorry, one last thing. One other woman in the book whose name is Angelica, she was clean for 6 or 8 years, and she worked at 24-hour fitness. And she worked her way up to be a manager, a regional manager, and then she was there 5 years, and she was so good, they kept moving her up and moving her up. But when she got to the point that she was going to be head of all the programs, one of which had kids, they did a tighter security clearance and found more of her criminal history. And they said, after 5.5 years, you got to go.
Oh.
Because something she would manage had something to do with children. None of her felonies ever had to do with anything to do with children. So I'm just saying, today, right here, the obstacles are immense. And if we want to lessen what we're paying for people to be locked up, we have to create better opportunities for them to succeed on the outside.
A lot of this is not common knowledge. Is that true? And is that...
I think people have a basic understanding, or progressive people in the Bay Area, that there's a lot of barriers to formerly incarcerated getting out, but the specificity of those barriers and really how you can be... you could come out with great intentions, but the capability, unless you've got some advocates, unless you find a program that's really going to walk you through some steps, like I said, the pulls of the street are a lot stronger.
Alice, you served 5 years in Valley State Prison. Can you talk a little bit about the services and the programs that were available to you on the inside?
Well, there was different programs for each of us. I mean, because when I went in, I had 5 years clean time behind me. However, I didn't want to work, so I kept reiterating that I needed a substance abuse program inside the prison because I didn't want to do such hard labor for no money.
Like what?
Like I worked in the kitchen and I made $0.05 an hour. I worked in optometrist and I think I made $0.10 an hour. So I wanted to do a program instead. However, I had my AA at the time and I had to work. I didn't get the opportunities of doing the programs. Then I decided I wanted to go into get the state license to be an optometrist, and I didn't have enough time to get into the program.
How are these decisions made, Mickey? Whether you work in the kitchen or you work in the library, or you get into a program.
Classification. Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
Classification. When an inmate goes into an institution, whether or not it's for their first time or whether or not they are a repeat visitor, there is a classification process that happens where they use like the point system. What is your past criminal history? Do you have children? Have you graduated from high school? What is the level or type of crime? And so they classify you on levels, level 1 through 4. That's why there's different types of penitentiaries for different level of inmates. So that's what happens, and that's how they determine. Each job gives you a level of connection with administration, with certain tools, with certain populations. And so it's all about the classification that determines where you're able to work, whether or not it's in the laundry, whether or not it's in the kitchen around utensils and so forth. They'll look at all of your background, and they will even consider other family members that you have that have been incarcerated, which will determine your points as well.
That is Nicole Petway. She spent 5 years in county jails and 8 years in California state prisons. She's a certified addictions treatment counselor and is completing her bachelor's. Alice Washington was in and out of county jail and served 5 years in Valley State Prison. She has a drug and alcohol counseling certificate and a BA in psychology. She's working on her master's as a family therapist. Alice and Nicole are two of 20 formerly incarcerated prisoners who are on display at the Welcome Home Project exhibit on the third floor of Oakland City Hall through October 29th. Mickey Duxbury interviewed these 20 formerly incarcerated people about their childhoods being in and out of prison and the challenges involved when they got out for the last time and re-entered society. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798.
This is a rebroadcast episode of Your Call. We're not accepting calls right now at this time, but thank you.
The stereotypes we have about people who've spent time in prison for major crimes. So what are your thoughts about that? What are your thoughts about what we hear on a regular basis? Lock them up. And, you know, we don't really talk about their past story. Do you think that this is a way to really reach out? I mean, if you have stereotypes, how do you feel about hearing their stories? And then if you've been incarcerated or if you know someone who has and you want to share your experience about what it was like to readjust back to society, we'd love to hear from you. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Jim in San Francisco. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Great show, and I really appreciate the conversation and all the points that you've all been making. I'm just wondering, I mean, like I think about men in Guantanamo, and they really are damaged through the process of the incarceration. They come out worse than they are when they go in, by and large. And if we as a society aren't going to care for them, you know, some people feel like, well, now they're a danger, so we can't let them out. And that's just horrific logic, this self-fulfilling prophecy thing. And I hope that people who advocate for tough-on-crime sort of throw away the key reflect on that, because people don't deserve that. So I hope that people read the book and, or, I mean, just really personally connect to the stories. And I just wanted to thank you. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Jim. Mickey?
I just want to add in to that comment about the impact of incarceration, and I want to be clear to listening on it. I'm not saying that there's no role at all for incarceration at any point, but we are saying that a large bulk of people that wind up in jail and prison have had major trauma throughout their lives, are pulled into drugs and pulled into, crime connected to drugs, and not getting the treatment. So prison in and of itself, in the that don't have the adequate programs, can become even further traumatizing. And I'm sure somebody hearing is going, well, why shouldn't they be further traumatized? It's prison. They're in prison. They did something wrong. Well, when you just said, well, that throw away the key, it's not just throwing away the key with those kinds of views. We are throwing away people. Most people that are incarcerated, hundreds and hundreds of thousands, millions that have been incarcerated in California, if you look at the last 30 years, come back home. And if we're going to have people back home and make our communities also safe and their communities safe, they need the opportunity to be able to change. And that we also need to look at then the impact of incarceration on people that are already traumatized. A large bulk of people that are on the inside have mental health issues. I want to say something about many of the men that I interviewed. It was so clear that there's hyper-masculine, aggressive role model that is in society and completely held up in prison, that when they're going in, there were some of these guys that went into Santa Rita jail the first day and they're 18, and they get in there and they said, well, I was scared the first day when I saw people look like they were in cages, but then I got into it, you know, that... Wow. You know, that kind of aggressive, completely shut down. There are a million studies on what institutionalization of incarceration does to the psyche. And so in many ways, it creates, I'm not saying it creates more crime, but it creates someone who's even more locked down.
Well, what was your experience like? And maybe you can talk about some of the women that you met in prison. Alice?
My experience.
How did it change you?
It changed me because, one thing, it made me sit with myself and realize and think that this is not what I want. I never want to come back here again. I never want to be locked down, but I was grateful to be locked out at the time for the crime that I had committed, because it made me sit back and realize this is not how you was brought up, so you need to take a look at, you know, what's going on with you. And besides, when you get out, I had to be a parent. And it was like that 5-year gap. When I went in, my daughter was 5. When I got out, she was 10. Mm-hmm. I missed out. Even though I seen her Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, I wasn't able to nurture her like a mother should have been there to nurture her, you know. And it was like, well, I was scared to death. So it was, I was grateful to be there to get to know who I was, to reevaluate myself. But it was a scary, I was more afraid to come back, not knowing, being an ex-offender, what life, what it was going to be like out here for me with the ex-offender tail behind me.
So I wanted to thank the caller, Jim, for the point that he raised about the trauma that we do experience. So you come from the trauma of, for me, I came from the trauma of sexual abuse, the trauma of the streets, you know, and I can remember in 1993 in Chowchilla State Prison, I gave birth some 21 years ago to my son. And I can remember giving birth in Merced County Hospital at 2:35 in the afternoon, and I was back in the institution for count time by 11 o'clock. Now, I don't know if that has changed since then, but the trauma of, and I don't know if it was my child that was crying as I was being shackled back down and put on the elevator, but just the memory of having, you know, giving birth to my child and having to leave. I mean, we don't even take puppies from a dog until they're 6 weeks, you know, and that was traumatizing for me. I can remember going back and the girls asking, well, what did you have? And, you know, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, all I could do was just put my pillow over my head and cry.
Do you mind me asking what you were in for at that time?
Why? I was drug sales. I had too many probation revocations and reinstatements, and I can remember the I wanted treatment. I wanted to go into a residential treatment program because I was due. This was January of 1993, and I was due to give birth sometime May or June. I didn't know because I wasn't getting any prenatal care at the time. And the judge said, well, maybe your baby will have an opportunity. And, of course, I did 3 years. I was sentenced to 3 years in state prison. And, of course, I, you know, because I got myself together, I was able to get my son back. But that was only through the efforts of...
We're almost out of time, but I want to ask you, I mean, one of your main objectives here is to challenge the stereotypes we have about people who've been in prison, but to also look at the whole being. Because when a major crime is committed, again, it's easy to say that person belongs in jail. How do you reach people to say, well, something happened to this person to get them to do this? I mean, that's...
Well, I think... And that's some of the intention of this booklet, and I think your radio show and what you're doing right now is, I think, people not demonizing, hearing real stories of real people. I just got to add, yeah. Alice, we haven't talked much about families, and, you know, you have talked about Alice having spent 5 years when her daughter was between 5 and 10 years old. That was for a parole violation. She went back for a parole violation. I'm not saying it wasn't serious. I'm not saying she shouldn't have shown back up in Fresno County when they told her to, but she was clean. She was in San Francisco. She was in a housing program. She was working, and she had a daughter, and that daughter was about to come out on a play for Martin Luther King Day at school, and Alice is sitting there waiting to see her daughter. She says, where's my daughter? Where's my daughter? The principal says, here, take this number, call. She calls. Someone says, okay, we're going to come by. Your daughter's okay. She's at San Francisco General. Alice goes, gets in an unmarked car that picks her up. There's a police card at the bottom. She finds out the gig is up. I've been underground for a couple of years. So did anybody say, you have a kid that's five? You've been clean for 3 years? You are working? No. They said, you're going to go back to 5 years. That costs California taxpayers about $250,000 to put her in jail for a parole violation when her child was in those formative years. And we have to look at those kinds of policies.
Is that Jolene?
Jerrine.
Uh-huh. Well, I think we have Jerrine on the line right now. Hi, Jerrine. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead. You're on with your mom.
Hi, Mom.
Don't cry, baby. Everything is all right.
I want to say that I'm so proud of you. I am so proud of you. And thank you for doing this project with my mom, because I don't have the courage to speak about things like this, but my mom does. And I just want to say thank you so much for everything, and getting clean and being clean and everything you've been going through in school. I'm so proud of you. And oh my God, I just can't stop crying. I'm at home listening. I have everyone listening. Matthew is so proud of you. Everyone's on Facebook going crazy. So I just want to say thank you guys for the opportunity of having my mom on here to tell her story so people can know, like, she's not a bad person. She made mistakes. She changed her life. And she's just human at the end of the day. So thank you, Mom, so much for everything. And I love you, okay?
I love you too, baby. You're welcome. You got the whole radio station crying.
Yes, you got us all in tears.
And that's what we need to do. Back to your question. We have to make these people real. We have to humanize them with the full breadth. And we are all responsible for the conditions that led to criminality. It's our society. And we have to undo them. And we have to welcome people home so they're affirmed and valued, because then they can make changes.
Mickey Duxbury is project coordinator with the Welcome Home Project. It's on display on the third floor of Oakland City Hall through October 29th. Alice Washington and Nicole Petway are in the project, and I just want to thank you all for sharing your stories and coming in today. And
thank you so much,
Mickey.
Thank you.
Thank you. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for listening. It's Your Call.
On the December 23rd, 2014 edition of Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Tavis Smiley, author of Death of a King, The Real Story of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s Final Year. In his last year, King was campaigning against many of the same issues we still face today: poverty, racism, and war overseas. So what is the true legacy of the famous civil rights leader, and how is it making an impact today? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.